So let me tell you what I'm planning to do for the first couple of classes, especially in view of the fact that people missed, even people who came for the class missed it today. Which is, first of all, today I'm just going to talk about Torah study in general. Next time I'm going to do a review of where we started and up to where we are. So we'll have basically two introductory classes. And then the time after that, I'll start with the Joseph story, which means that we're going to begin the class on chapter, I think, 37 of Genesis, okay? But if you weren't here over the last couple of years, and you don't know what happened up to chapter 37 of Genesis, don't worry about it, because I'm going to go over that next time, okay? All right, so, but for this time, I'm going to go over just general Torah study and what you'll hear over the next however long, and then take any questions. So the reason that I'm doing this is because there really are two sort of separate schools of ways of studying the Torah, and we use both here. One is classical and one is modern, and they're not the same, even though they overlap. The classical school, first of all, obviously assumes that God wrote every word of the Torah. So because God wrote every word of the Torah, it's not possible for the Torah to contradict itself or to have real problems. If there's a problem in the text, it's because we haven't understood it correctly. And everything is reconcilable. So when it says in one place that you should roast the Passover sacrifice, and in the other place it says that you should boil the Passover sacrifice, you turn to the very end of the Torah, which says you should roast and boil it, okay? Now, the modern school says that the Torah is composed of different documents written at different times by different people based on ancient traditions. They'll say one person had the tradition of roasting, one had the tradition of boiling, and when the later chronicler saw the contradiction, he tried to reconcile them, okay? That matters in part because of how you understand different sort of contradictions in the story. So you'll see all sorts of problems which can have creative solutions in terms of character and plot and so on, but also can have solutions in terms of these are just from different sources and so people have different traditions. When you read the Torah, we use lots of different kinds of readings, and I'm going to name a couple of them because all of them get used and sometimes intermixed, but we should be aware of them. The one that doesn't get used in modern study, only gets used in ancient study, is called source criticism. And source criticism means, where did this story come from? Now, people who believe, I'll give you just a little historical reminder for those of you who've been here before, people who believe that the Torah was put together by lots of different sources, this is what they think happened, okay? Israel was united for a very short time, only under David and Solomon, basically. And then Solomon's kids fought, and there was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom, okay? Jerusalem was sort of closer to the middle of the country, which is probably why David picked it as his capital, but it ended up being the capital of the southern kingdom, okay? The northern kingdom, which means the 10 tribes, all those tribes that got lost, the southern kingdom was mostly Judah and centered around Jerusalem. The northern kingdom was destroyed by the Assyrians in 722 BCE, long time ago, okay? What happened to all those 10 tribes? Now, when you've been separated for, I don't know, I guess close to 300 years, because that's how long the break was, then you develop different traditions, right? I mean, Canada and the United States were never the same country, but they have the same common stock, but they have very different, even though they're the same, they're also different, right? So what happened to the 10 tribes? Some of them probably assimilated, some of them died, and some of them obviously ran to their closest cousins in the south. And so some of the 10 tribes from the north came south. The people in the south had their own traditions. When the North and the South combined, according to some, they combined with two different traditions of what the Torah was about and what the Torah stories were about and so on. And they had to interweave them so that it would make one coherent story, which is why, for example, according to some modern scholars, sometimes God is called Elohim and sometimes God is called Adonai. because those were two different traditions from the North and from the South. And then, according to most scholars, you add two other kinds of traditions. One is the tradition that the priests had, right, the Kohanim in the temple, because every professional organization looks at the world its own way, right, which is different from the way the people around them look. And then there was a later tradition which has to do with the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, which tells people different things than the rest of the Bible. For example, Devarim says that you shouldn't have local synagogues all over the place. You have to centralize worship in only one place. It doesn't say that in the other parts of the Bible, which gives scholars who believe that the Bible was written by lots of different people an idea that that was a tradition of Deuteronomy that wasn't a tradition of other strands of the Bible. So there you get, in very brief compass, the idea that lots of different things went into the making of the Bible. And when the southern kingdom now was destroyed, 150 years later, this is the destruction of the temple, Tisha B'Av, 586 or 7 BCE, when the Babylonians destroyed the temple and we went, you know, Al Naharot Bavel, on the road to Babylon, where we wept and so on. This is the destruction of the first temple. There were two of them. Later, Romans, we don't have to get into that now. When that happened, according to some scholars, exactly what always occurs in times of catastrophe happened, which is stuff that was spoken orally, because the ancient world was all about oral traditions. People didn't write things down. It was much harder to write than to tell the story to your children. Things that were oral, were everybody was afraid they were going to get lost. People were scattered, people were dying, so they started to combine the traditions in writing, and all of a sudden you got the Torah, okay? Now that's a very different picture from the picture of the Torah that we get growing up at school. And you can see why people who accept picture number two and picture number one come up with very different explanations for what the Torah is trying to tell you. In this class, we accept all explanations. This isn't a class in theology. We don't know how the Torah was put together. We want to look at it from as many different angles as possible. And by the way, what you get are three very broad categories. One is the Torah is written by human beings, collection of traditions. The second is Torah is written by human beings, but express God's will. The third is the Torah is written exclusively by God. Okay, so there's either collaboration or one or the other. And you can pick your, you know. And in fact, as you study Torah, you may actually find yourself feeling differently about it at different times. But one of the wonderful things about our age, which others did not have in the past, is that not only do we have the traditions of the Torah, but we have the traditions of the civilizations around the Torah. So we now know more about the Torah than people did in any other age, because now we know the languages that people spoke at the same time that the Torah was being written. So when we study, for example, why did Isaac and Abraham call their wives their sisters, which you may remember from the past couple of years, we now know that that was a motif, that was something that happened in other civilizations around them at the time. So it's not completely out of the blue and isolated. In the same way, the way that Robert Alter, in his book on the Bible, talks about it is this, a great way to do it. He says, imagine only one Western movie survived, right? One Western. So a guy rides across the screen with a white hat, and you have no idea that a white hat means good and a black hat means bad, because you only have one Western. He said, now it may be that the guy with the white hat turns out good in that Western, but you don't necessarily know that the white hat means that. You might guess it does, you might not guess, you might guess this guy just likes white. But once you start to discover other stories in the area where good guys wear white hats, you've all of a sudden learned something about the Torah, even though it's not in the Torah. Which I always thought was a great way of understanding what it means to study the other cultures around the Torah, and also to remind us how little we know about the Torah, since we don't live in that world. Because there are probably thousands of cues in the text that we don't understand, because an ancient reader would know them automatically, and unfortunately, that's lost to us. The best we have, which is pretty good, but it's not perfect, is the rabbinic tradition, which maintains old readings of the Torah that go back God knows when. I mean, you actually don't know how far back something goes, right? You know when something stops, you can never know when something starts, right? It could have been 500 years old, or it could have been 1,000 years old, who knows? So all of that you bring to the reading of the Torah, and therefore you get very, as I said, very different sorts of explanations. And I thought I would give you one example of that. I brought one example, and then I also want to talk about what you should bring to the class or not bring to the class. Let me give you, here's an example that that isn't in what we're going to be doing this year. You don't have to open it. I'll read it to you very quickly, and you'll get the idea. So in the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, which we won't get to for like 17 years at the pace that we go, remember the people are complaining. They're always complaining in the desert, right? There isn't a lot to do in the desert, so they complain. This is what it says. The riffraff, that is the less good element, in their midst felt a gluttonous craving. And the Israelites wept and said, if only we had meat to eat. Okay? They didn't have meat in the desert, obviously, and they wanted meat. If only we had meat to eat. Now, the only problem with that is if you go back to Exodus, which we'll get to in like 3 years, probably before, but if you go back to Exodus, this is what it says. Thus says the Lord, Moses said, toward midnight I will go forth among the Egyptians, and every firstborn shall die, and this one will that one, and there'll be a loud cry, and then they go out of Egypt. And you know what they go out with? Cattle, sheep, all these things that are meat. So how could it be that all of a sudden they're complaining that there's no meat to eat when they have these huge flocks and herds that they go out of Egypt with, along with all this gold that they make the golden calf out of? So there are at least 5 different explanations of this, right? But let me just give you the first easy explanation based on what we just said, different traditions. One tradition is they went out empty-handed. And you know, people always ask, how did they get anything in the desert? Because the natural assumption is they walked into the desert empty-handed. I mean, who leaves slavery with flocks and herds, right? So different traditions are there was one tradition that they left empty-handed, which makes sense. The other tradition is they left with flocks and herds, where this doesn't make sense. But I didn't read you the next sentence. They felt a glut. If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish that we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Now our gullets are shriveled. There's nothing but this manna to look at. Okay? The next sentence after we don't have meat to eat is we remember fish. So some commentators say it wasn't meat that they really wanted. It was fish, and they referred to fish as meat. Because there certainly is no fish in the desert. Of course, part of the problem with that is they say there's only this manna to look at. They don't say there's only this manna and lamb to look at. But that's one explanation. But then the fact that there's, and this is one of the things that makes studying the Torah so wonderful, the fact that this contradiction is in there allows the commentators who assume that everything is intentional to make some very beautiful points. It says, Avu ta'ava, they craved a craving. That's the Hebrew, okay? So they wanted, according to one commentator, according to Rashi, what they wanted was to want something. God gave them everything, and they craved craving. So they complained because they didn't like the idea that everything in their life was provided for them, which is a beautiful idea. And couldn't be generated by somebody who says, oh, it's different sources, right? You have to assume that the Torah means what it means in order to get that kind of idea. Actually, Rashi says it was a pretext. The other idea was what they really wanted back. What represents meat that they lost? The golden calf. That what they really missed was the golden calf. And the reason that they missed the golden calf in the desert was because the one thing that you can't do in the desert is see anything, right? and God was visible with the golden calf. They could see it, they could touch it, it was real, and they missed that. Now they only have each other, and God's gone. And even though God may be this intangible thing in the sky, remember, they weren't used to that. This was a new idea for them. So that's another possibility of what it was. And then there was that's sort of similar. One says that they were in love with complaining itself, but, yeah, exactly. The commentator says they craved a craving, the Sfat Emet. Someone comments on him and says, do you know how you feel when you finish a good meal? What you really want a good meal again. You feel full, right? But the wanting and the having was much better than the feeling of fullness. So what they wanted was to have that feeling again. That's why they craved a craving, because everybody wants to have that desire to crave things. So anyway, the point of all this is that you get, and we've seen these explanations again and again and again in Genesis 2, that you get multiple explanations for the same thing depending on what assumption you bring to the text, okay? So there's that part. Lastly, I wanted to mention three other kinds of ways of reading the Bible, and then we'll take questions, and then next time we'll do a review. I mentioned that there's something called, the word criticism is not a great word, but it's called source criticism. In other words, a way of reading the Bible that looks at its sources. That's one, okay? The second way of reading the Bible is the way that looks at the form. And what I mean by the form is, let's say I start a story and it begins with once upon a time. What is it?
A fairy tale.
Isn't that amazing that you know that? That's called form criticism. It's the way you tell something tells you what you're about to hear. So when I say once upon a time, you immediately know it's going to be, or if I say knock knock, you know it's going to be a joke. Right. So the Bible, certain things like the story of Joseph, which is a self-contained story that we're going to study this year, is kind of like a novella. And here's a really interesting thing about a novella. We'll return to this again, but here's the difference between a short story and a novel, okay? I mean, obviously, the length, but in a short story, a character doesn't develop. A character doesn't start off as one thing and end up as another because it's not long enough. In a short story, what you get is a revelation of the character. You don't know what the person is like at the beginning. By the end of the short story, it's supposed to show you something about that person that you didn't otherwise know. It's what James Joyce, the great author, called an epiphany, right? All of a sudden you go, oh, I thought he was like this, but actually now I discover that this is what this character is like. In a novel, you get character development. If somebody's the same at the end of the novel as they are at the beginning, not a very good novel because they haven't learned anything. They've had all these experiences, all these things have happened. They're supposed to change, right? A novella's in the middle. So you could get one, you could get the other. You could get both. And one of the things about the Joseph story that we have to look at is who changes? Have they actually changed? Are we just revealing that? But you don't ask those questions unless you already know that it's a novella, that it's a long short story or a short long story, right? It's actually the longest short story in the Torah about one thing, and it's interrupted, as we'll see, by what seems to be a story about something completely different, about Judah and Tamar and so on, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. But once you know the form of something, you ask yourself different questions than if you don't know the form. Like at the end of the knock knock, you ask yourself, was that funny or wasn't it? You don't ask that at the end of a fairy tale. It's not a natural question. Maybe it's funny, maybe it isn't, but that's not what a fairy tale is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about the moral at the end, right? So once you know what the form is, and so there's a whole school of critics called form critics that try to figure out the different forms of the Bible so they know what questions to ask of each story. Yeah, it gets very complicated. Then there are critics, which we're not going to do very much of at all, who look at the text itself. Because one thing that nobody learns until you go to rabbinical school, and most of you probably won't, for which, good for you, because look where it gets you. But When you go to rabbinical school, they give you this big book, which I think I still have, although I've never looked at from the moment the class was over, called the Biblica Hebraica Stuttgart, which, as you can tell, is a German book. And what it is it lists every known old manuscript of the Torah and the differences between them. Because people will tell you that every old manuscript of the Torah is the same, but that's absolutely, unequivocally untrue. In fact, we have no two old manuscripts of the Torah that are the same. Every single one has differences. Now, the differences, believe me, are minor. It's not like in one place called Abraham and the other place, you know, he's Sidney. They're really minor, but there are differences between them. A letter left in, a letter left out, a word sometimes left in, a word left out. And not only do we have that, but don't forget, or learn anew, depending, that the Torah was translated in ancient times. The first time, what, anybody know the first translation, what it was in?
Greek.
Greek. Yes. The very first, the second was Aramaic, the first was Greek. In the time, like shortly after the book of Daniel was written, in other words, in basically in biblical times, there was a translation called the Septuagint, which means the 70, because according to the legend, 70 different scholars translated it, and they came together after they each worked on it individually, and miraculously, their translation was exactly the same. Okay, but doesn't matter what the story is. The point is, the Torah was translated in ancient times, right, before the rabbis we're talking about, really old, okay? And the translation preserves different readings than we have, or the translators decided to change things. Either way, it's very interesting that the Septuagint has different readings of the Torah than the Torah does, and so does the Aramaic translation done later, and that was done during the time of the rabbis. What this tells you, by the way, is Jews always needed translations of the Torah. In Greek times they needed it, in rabbinic times they needed it, so if you bring a translation of the Torah, don't be upset with yourself, because it's not new. But the translation either reflects the fact that the Torah was a little bit different, the Torah they had, or reflects the fact that they didn't want to translate for people things in the Torah that they didn't like, okay? So now some of the translations, I'll give you one example. Some of the translations are interpretations, but they're beautiful interpretations. So Uncalus, who was an ancient translator of the Torah and a convert, by the way, and his translation of the Torah is printed in every standard Chumash. When you go into any synagogue in the world, you always have Uncalus' translation next to Rashi and next to the Torah. He translates the God's creation of Adam as God created a speaking soul, which is a beautiful thing. Nobody believes that that was originally in the Torah. What they believe is that that was the common way of understanding what it meant to create a human being. So he put it in his Aramaic translation, because remember, the translation wasn't for the scholars. The translation was for the people who were coming to the synagogue. And as somebody read the Torah, someone would stand next to them and call out the Aramaic translation. They didn't have books. They would call out the Aramaic translation. So someone would read a few sentences, and then the meturgamon, the translator, would speak out what he had just read. So he wanted them to understand what it meant to create a human being is to create a speaking soul. And in that way, it's not actually so different from what we do now, except that we have books, and they probably, I don't know if they paid more attention or not. It's, all right, so the, so that's textual criticism. That is trying to figure out, I'll give you the best example of textual criticism in some ways in the whole Torah, in the whole large Torah, that is the Torah, the Nevi'im, Ketuvim, the whole Bible, is in the book of Job, there's something in the Torah called Kri and Ketiv, that is the way you're supposed to read the word and the way it's written, and they're not always the same. And sometimes if you look at the bottom of your text, you'll see little letters down here. Usually it's because you're supposed to read it one way and say it another way, okay? One of the most famous lines in the book of Job is, even if God kills me, I will still believe in him, okay? All right, I won't despair, I won't give up hope, basically. I'll still believe in him. And that's because it's, even if God kills me, lo, lamed vav, which means in him, ayachel, I will hope, okay? Except that's not the way the text reads. The text reads lamed aleph. I will not believe in him. If God kills me, I won't believe in him. But the tradition says you should read that understanding lamed vav in him as opposed to lamed aleph, which means no. Now that changes the entire meaning of everything depending on which way you read it, right? So it really does matter how you decide to read a word. I mean, that's not usually quite that dramatic, but that's a pretty big deal. So that's source criticism, form criticism, textual criticism, and literary criticism, which means, you know, trying to figure out how different words connect up. For example, we'll see in the Joseph story, when there's this break for Judah and Tamar, that certain words used there will link back to the story before and the story after, and they'll let you know words that are used are supposed to remind you of other things. So, for example, when the word that's used for an ark in the Noah story is also used for Moses' basket when he's put on the Nile. And you're supposed to make that link if you're a careful reader of the Torah, and remember that most ancient readers of the Torah read it over and over and over and over and over and over again. They knew it by heart. So they realized that Moses saves the world the way Noah saved the world. And they just make that link. And that's literary criticism, right? And the rabbis do that a lot, because the rabbis assume that every word of the Torah is given by God, so it's not a mistake that the same word is used for the ark and for Moses's ark, basically. And then the one that we do most, the two that we do most, are what you almost want to call psychological criticism, especially in the book of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus, which is trying to get an insight into the minds of the characters. And just because that interests me the most and seems to interest this class the most, that's most of what we do, right? So why is it that that Jacob favors Joseph? And why is it that that Esau doesn't kill Jacob when he sees him after, you know, decades, when he swore that he would kill him? And parents and children and husbands and wives and brothers and sisters and all of that, which is really, especially the book of Genesis concentrates on, is, and the one, you know, when you get to the legal, I'm still playing with this idea, when you get to the legal parts of the Torah, there are other parts of the Torah that have the same kinds of stories, and the best for me, which we may do, who knows, when we get to the legal parts of the Torah, we may just take a detour into the book of Samuel, where you get the stories of David and Bathsheba and Avshalom and the rebellions. And the story of David, like the story of Genesis, is all about parents and children and God and human beings and how they interact. And it's quite wonderful and fascinating. And I want to do it in part because once you leave school, nobody ever studies the parts of the Torah that you don't read in synagogue every week. So we'll see. And then lastly, of course, and in some ways most important, is you try to figure out what the Torah teaches you about God and about Judaism, which is, again, you could just do that and not anything else and spend the rest of our, you know, the rest of our time with that, which is as something, again, as simple as, so if God wanted Jacob to have the birthright, first of all, why did he make Esau the firstborn? Why did he have to trick him? Why did he just tell Isaac to give Jacob the birthright instead of having Rebekah go through this subterfuge? Why is Isaac blind? What's the symbolism of that? Why does God make him blind? Why does God, we're going to read this week the Akedah, right, the binding of Isaac. Surely no story in the Torah raises more troubling questions about God and what God wants of human beings and why God would ask such a thing. So all of those things too are the way that we look at the Torah, and when you put them all together, you can see why it's just endless and involuted, and you can spend an enormous amount of time on any single sentence, much less chapters and stories. Okay, so let me stop there for now and ask for questions or comments or anything. Yeah, Sean.
Can you speak for a moment on the Haftarah and the importance of study?
I can. The thing about, we don't do the Haftarah here, because the way the Haftarah, which is the prophetic portion, let me start this way. The book that you can bring any translation of the Torah you want. I don't care. Anyone you want, and different translations may give different insights. I tell people to bring this only because this has the entire Bible in it, right? The Eitz Chaim, which you use in synagogue, it does not have the entire Bible in it. The Bible is what's called a step canon, okay? That means it's canonized. These are all sacred books, right? This is the Jewish Bible. This is the Hebrew Bible, okay? The Torah sometimes only refers to the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, right? Bereishit through Devarim. But really, the Torah, in a bigger sense, refers to all these books. So this is the way it works. Tanakh means Torah, those five books. Nevi'im. The Nevi'im are the historical books, Joshua, Judges, Samuel 1 and 2, Kings 1 and 2, and also the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Amos, okay, all those guys, all right? That's all in the Nevi'im, all in the prophets. Okay, I'll get to the third part in a second. The Haftarah is taken from the Nevi'im. So what happens is, each week, we read a selection of the Torah, and then a bar bat mitzvah kid will read the Haftarah, and nobody knows what that means. It sounds like they're doing half of the Torah, right? But that's not what it means, actually. The Haftarah means they're going to read a selection from Nevi'im. So sometimes it'll be Joshua, but usually it'll be Isaiah is the most common. Jeremiah is the next most common. Ezekiel, those are the three, they're called the three major prophets. Not major only because they're very important, but because they have the longest books, okay? Then there are 12 what are called minor prophets, but it only means that their books are short, the Treasar, the 12. So you read from the Torah each week, and then you read a selection from the Haftarah. And the Haftarah, in one way or another, links up to the Torah. How sometimes is obscure, sometimes it's very clear, but it always does, okay? But some of the most interesting books of the Bible are in this division, which is Ketuvim. That's why it's called Tanakh, right? Ketuvim means writings, and writings includes Psalms, an important one, Proverbs, Job, Ruth, Jonah, Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. I mean, some of the most interesting books of the Bible are in the third division of the Bible called Ketuvim. Now, we don't normally study those in the course of the average year, although we read them on some holidays, but we'll see. We'll see what we'll do. Yeah?
You explained at the beginning of the class that there is one classic way of...
Right.
Does that depend on how religious and how observant you are? If you're reformed, you believe in modern and if you're...
The answer, okay, so the question is, the way you read the Torah, does that depend on how, where you are, Reformed, Conservative, Orthodox, along the spectrum? The answer is, most of the time, yes. Most of the time, yes. So, for example, somebody in the, this is complicated. Somebody in the ultra-Orthodox community would never, ever accept the idea of source criticism, because there's only one source. Someone in the Reformed community, if they're aware of this, everybody in the world who studies the Bible, who is not a believer, assumes that it's put together from different documents, okay? Everybody. Like, if you go to a university class on the Bible, there's no class that you will ever take with a modern scholar where he'll say this all came from one source. The only people who will say it came from one source are people who believe that it was given by God. They already have that commitment. Among people who believe it was given by God, this is the way it breaks down. I would say the Reform movement and almost all the conservative movement would say in some way it's a collaboration. There's too much evidence of human fingerprints to believe that it's only God. So either it's all people or a collaboration. In the Orthodox community, there's a kind of interesting division. In the more Orthodox circles, God gave it, no question about it, nothing to be said. In modern Orthodoxy, they have a real dilemma. I actually have a book of essays about this. So because they do modern study of the Bible, because modern Orthodoxy does not want to close itself off from the academic, but they can't accept the conclusions of modern study. So there's a great deal of struggle with how do you study the Bible in a modern way, but not accept any of the conclusions of modern scholars. And it's tough. It's a tough ideological battle. But yes, anyway, I'll leave it at that, because we could talk about this a lot. It's a great division in religious life, depending on what you assume about the origin of the Torah.
Yeah. Can I piggyback on that and say you created lots of dialogue about this maybe a decade
right.
ago. Could you expand on both your position and the conservative position in terms
I
of
could, but it would yeah. take a long time. I'm going to save that for the moment. So, yeah, go ahead.
Can you explain Ezekiel's vision of
I could, but that also would take a long time. The reason I'm evading both of these is, first of all, let me tell you why. Because I don't want to, I would rather not make this class about my theology, because I want to leave it open to everybody's theology. What I believe actually matters less. I've said it before in previous ones. What I believe about it matters less. All I will say to you is that I believe there's both God and human being in this text. Okay? But I'm going to leave it just at that. I don't read this like I read Shakespeare. Right? I think it's holy. And it's the only book that I know of that's holy, other than other Jewish holy books. Right? But on the other hand, there's no doubt in my mind that there's a human contribution to this. I have no doubt. But that doesn't bother me, actually. I think in some ways that makes it more beautiful, not less. And the second is, the problem with elaborating with Ezekiel's vision of the chariot is that that's all of ancient Jewish mysticism, is called Ma'aseh Merkava, the doings of the chariot. And it's a big, big topic. But there is, I mean, that's, again, that's Jewish mysticism, which is a different class, so I'm going to leave that. What's that?
Which book is it from?
From the first book of Ezekiel. I mean, from the first chapter of Ezekiel. You'll see it at the very beginning of Ezekiel has this vision of chariots and angels that the rabbis and the more ancient books of Jewish mysticism take as one of the forms of Jewish mysticism, called mysticism of the chariot, basically. Which is a really interesting subject, but would take us really far afield. Yeah, Mary?
One way of looking at the Torah, the different ways of looking at it, does it also have some kind of political effect on Israel? And
yes.
Maybe that's one.
It does. If you believe that the Torah was given, well, here the interesting thing is, if you believe that the Torah was given by God, then you still can't escape the fact that in different parts of the Torah, it gives different boundaries to the land of Israel. But for some reason that I'm going to leave up to you, people who are more devout tend to assume that the largest boundary is the one God really meant. And the smaller boundaries, God was just, you know. But it clearly does. I mean, look, let's talk about Hebron, for example. By any standard, Hebron is, next to Jerusalem, the holiest city in the history of the Jewish people. It just is. You may like to get around it, but you know, that was Abraham's city. And that's where Ma'arat HaMachpelah is. That's where he's buried. That's where Sarah's buried. That's a really holy place. On the other hand, it also happens to be one of those places that, if there ever is a Palestinian state, is going to end up clearly in a Palestinian state and is never going to end up in the Jewish state by any map that anyone's ever drawn. So what do? Either you decide you have to have enough Jews around there to make it impossible for it ever to be Palestinian, because it's just holy and God gave it to us and that's it. Or you say, well, peace is more important than holding of that land, and you assume that it's going to go back. And that has to do with a lot of things, but I certainly think that at least in the mix is whether you think the Torah is directly from God. So, but it's tricky. It's not easy. So, yeah, Abby.
For those who do believe that it comes from God, how do you explain the mechanics of it actually getting down on paper and somewhere?
That's actually a really, you know, I wonder about this, and I've asked people about this, and I've not gotten an entirely satisfactory answer, because the mechanics are tricky. I mean, for example, did Moses know that Korach was going to rebel against him? Because it happens after Sinai, right? So did he get the whole Torah beforehand? Well, sometimes what people will say is Moses was given the Torah gradually over the course of, he didn't get it all at Sinai, he was given it gradually, although that's not what the Talmud says. The Talmud says that everything that every student was ever going to say in any class of Torah, Moses was given at Sinai. So it's complicated, it depends which tradition you follow, but I guess it depends who you ask. But the assumption is that by the time Moses transmitted it to Joshua, it was either all in writing or all in writing in potential and was going to be committed to writing. According to one mystical doctrine, Nachmanides, Ramban, said that it was all black fire on white fire. Mm-hmm. That's what the Torah was, and that's how they carried it through the desert until it finally got committed to actual parchment later. But it's, I mean, the mechanics of it are difficult, and I don't know how you exactly get past that, especially in terms of Moses' foreknowledge. Because how does Moses not know what's going to happen if God already told him? But that's a tricky one. So, you know, that's why conservative rabbis love that midrash about Moses coming down to the, I don't know if you know this midrash, and it's a nice one to actually close up on. And it's, again, it's interpreted differently by different denominations, but you'll understand how conservative reform and modern scholars interpret this. This is in the Talmud, and what happens is Moses is up in heaven, and he sees God putting crowns on the letters of the Torah. Crowns are little, those things, if you've ever looked at actual Torah scroll, you'll see that all the letters are decorated in various ways with little crowns on them. And God says, what are you doing? They're called tagim, right? Tags or signs or crowns. So God says, there will arise a scholar one day who will interpret even these crowns of the Torah. So Moses says, can I be privileged to see him? And God says, yes. And Moses finds himself in the back of Rabbi Akiva's Beit Midrash. Okay? And he's in Rabbi Akiva's class. Nobody sees him, but he's there. And Rabbi Akiva starts saying all these things that Moses doesn't recognize. And Moses gets very upset. And then someone asks Rabbi Akiva, how do you know this? And he says, it's our tradition from Moses at Sinai. And he feels better. Okay? Now, what, and by the way, there's a tremendous postscript to that story, and I'll get to it in a second, which has nothing to do with this part of it. But now, what does that mean? According to modern scholars, it means that even the rabbis realized that they were saying things that although based on Moses' teaching were in fact innovations, that they knew they were innovating. According to traditional scholars, it doesn't mean that at all. In fact, it really means that they were elaborating things that Moses knew, and Moses just wanted to make sure that the tradition was still followed, whatever. Okay, so, but the postscript is actually in some ways even more powerful. It is more powerful than the story. What happens is later on, remember, Rabbi Akiva is martyred by the Romans. They rake his flesh with hot combs while he says the Shema. And Moses says, is this the Torah and this the reward? Right? Mm-hmm. Zet Torah v'zes Chora. Is this what he gets for being a great scholar of Torah? And God's answer is, quiet, this is my will. Mm-hmm. And that's it. God doesn't give him an explanation. So there's a lot in that story. But it also tells you that the rabbi struggled with the idea of, was what I just came up with in the Beit Midrash this morning really Moses' innovation, or was it mine? Last question.
Aren't we supposed to always reform our own, within the framework of our own generation? And isn't that exactly what Rabbi Akiva did?
Yes and no. Depends who you are. Are you asking me? If you ask me, yeah, of course. But if you ask a traditional scholar, they'll say, look, this is the way, the scheme, the traditional scheme of Torah study is as follows. God gave to Moses at Sinai. Moses gave to Joshua. Joshua to the elders on Sheikh Knesset HaGdolah, and on and on and on and on. We're here. So when you read it, you're reading it here. So yeah, you may figure out how it applies to electricity, but you only figure out how it applies to electricity if you check with this guy who knew so much more than you and was so much higher and so much closer to Sinai that you shouldn't think that your interpretation could in any way contradict his, although you may elaborate it in a way that he didn't elaborate it just because he wasn't alive today. So that's the catch, is it depends how you think the tradition works. Yeah?
Is that the oral Torah, or the...
Yes, that's the oral Torah. The written Torah is given, but the oral Torah is what determines the halakha, the law.
The Rambam, I think, determined 40 generations of documented or codified through Talmudic times.
Yeah, but the only way, there are various codes of Jewish law, but the only way they get authority is if people believe that they're more deeply rooted or deeply learned in what went before. So Rambam did, but then the Shulchan Aruch supplanted the Rambam. And the Mishnah Brura, by commenting on the Shulchan Aruch in a certain segments of the Jewish world, supplanted that, and on and on. But the only way you can supplant is by proving your authenticity to what went before. You can't supplant by saying, I have an insight they didn't have. You can supplant by saying, I have a more comprehensive knowledge of what they did, and let me tell you how it applies. So innovation is a very double-edged sword in something like the Jewish tradition, and you can understand why, because you can innovate a tradition right out of existence if you innovate enough. You know, soon you'll be having, like, female rabbis. Okay, and on that note...